once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome back to another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff
McClure. And that'll be enough of that. Holy two energeticness. We've got to stop that immediately. Too early in the morning. Wait a minute. We're economists. It's always too early in the morning to have energy. All right. So we got a lot to talk about this episode, this second hour. We've talked a little bit about the government shutdown, but and you talked a bit about the kind of perfect storm of weirdnesses hitting right now. But I think it's a good time to talk about that. We got a government shutdown. What's that going to do? Well, it's going to stop paying somewhere between 2 and 3 million people their monthly and semi-monthly checks. It's just not going to happen. There's going to be student loan repayment starting back up. And you were talking about a case that we can't actually talk about on the air, but what we have seen is that federal employees are going to be required to not get paid at the same time that they will be required to pay the federal government for their student loans again, which is just, that's not irony, by the way. This is sardonic. This is, I'm sorry, Alanis Morissette, isn't it ironic? Pedantically is totally wrong. It's, isn't it sardonic? Sardony is when two things collide that would be kind of funny normally, but not really anymore. Irony is when two happy things happen.
I think the 20 people who are busily shutting down the government who have no alternative except to, they're offering no alternative except to do my way or the highway, are failing to recognize, well, they either don't care. I can't believe they fail to recognize this. But a lot of our soldiers, many of whom were deployed overseas, have student loans. Or their wives or husbands have student loans.
The GI Bill exists, and it's really cool, but that isn't the only way people get, well, in a family, get their education.
In many cases, they got their education before they went in the armed forces, and they've got student loans to pay. And to cut their pay off arbitrarily, to stop paying them, and they have to be on the ones, particularly overseas. They're not going to be able to stay home because they've got places they need to guard things. I mean, if you got an aircraft carrier in the middle of the Pacific or an aircraft carrier that's over in the
just turn off the engines, everyone.
In the Western Pacific, that is
get out the fishing
countering
poles.
The Chinese.
Get out the fishing poles. Just, sorry, go ahead.
They can't just drop anchor and send everybody home. So those soldiers and those sailors and those airmen and women around the world, they got to keep working. And they have already received their notices from the federal government that the federal government will take action against them if they don't pay the student loans they haven't been paying since 2020. I just can't even imagine the thought process.
There isn't one.
In those representatives' minds to punish our soldiers who are defending our country.
I think they are so wrapped up in the tree that they're arguing about that they forgot that they're in a national forest. And they're arguing about the tree so much that the whole forest is suffering.
And I want to point out that when they shut the government down, the members of Congress still get paid.
Yeah, that's ironic for them. It's sardonic for the rest of us.
I will give John Carter his credit in our district here in Central Texas. He has announced that he has ordered his chief of staff to withhold his pay as long as the government is shut down. Now, he is not exactly poverty stricken. He is a very wealthy man, so it isn't probably won't hurt him one way or the other to not get his pay during that period, but at least he's doing something right. The people who are the radicals in the Republican Party, the 20 or so who are shutting down the government, I've not encountered any of them who are not going to get paid. They are going to continue to receive their money while millions of people don't get paid and are still required to pay their bills. I could get on a soapbox here really quickly. Having been a soldier, having been overseas, young soldiers particularly don't exactly have a big cash cushion to fall back on. And it's going to be interesting.
And you know, every time this happens, the government says to the landlords, hey, you need to have some respect for our soldiers. Here's the deal. You don't have respect for the soldiers if this is what's happening. This is Congress's lack of respect. You don't stop paying your employees because you can't agree on what to cut. You don't cut everything. I mean, this is when I said last hour, this is a fascinating little coincidence. Two incidences happening simultaneously that really are similar. The union has shut down a lot of the manufacturing for the three very large automakers in the United States, Stellantis, General Motors, and Ford. United Auto Workers have shut them down. Why? Because they're insisting that their pay goes up. And they're also insisting that the people who work in a factory producing parts for an internal combustion aren't going to lose their jobs when electric comes along. Well, the problem with that is exactly what's the problem at Congress. If you don't want to lose your job, insisting that you're not going to work unless you get paid more, there's a little bit of counterintuitiveness there. Now, I'm not trying to say they're getting paid enough or not getting paid enough, but one of the legs that this stool is standing on at the UAW is they don't want to lose their jobs to electric manufacturing. And that's going to require retooling. It's going to require education and training for the employees so that they can go to the new equipment. Well, in the middle of this, Congress is doing the same thing. We're not going to pay the soldiers because I didn't want 11 bills to decide on. I wanted 9 bills. And that was our agreement. You said we were going to have 9 bills to read, not 11. Well, the first bill, they didn't know how many bills they were going to be. And it was one of the agreed upon things. And that was the Department of Defense spending bill. That was presented and it was part of the original agreement. And the extreme end of the Republicans said they're not even going to approve that. Well, this is definitely a baby in the bathwater situation. I mean, there's not a whole lot of bathwater. It's mostly baby. And the same is true, I mean, kind of across the board. If you have a minority who's not really, by minority, I don't mean racial. I mean, a minority of people in a group who don't really care if the group suffers or does well. They don't really care. And they're stopping the rest of the group who for different reasons want different things, but in their own opinions, they want it because they think it's going to be better for the group. Democrats don't agree with Republicans on almost anything. And the Democrats will point at all the things that they think the Republicans are going to do to damage the future. And the Republicans don't agree with the Democrats, and they're going to point at all the things the Democrats are going to do to damage the future. But both of them, the vast majority of them, honestly believe that their views are valid and the best thing for the country. Then you have a small group of people in both parties who don't care about the well-being of the country. They have one or two things that for the rest of us are relatively minor that they're willing to sacrifice everything over. And that's where we're standing in multiple parts of our economy and the spending around it. Not just at the government, but this is the strikes at UPS. This is the strike. I mean, they're valid beliefs at UPS and UAW, by the way. They want better pay. Okay. But when you take it to such a drastic measure of if you don't agree with us, we're going to destroy the whole business, it better be a good reason. And it's really hard to point at this and say, yes, your angst over losing your jobs in 5 years, it's okay if it puts us into a recession today. And that's the weirdness, is that all of this stuff could combine if it's protracted into the very recession that we were poised to avoid. We're growing very quickly right now, but let's see how many things we can throw in the road to slow down the traffic. And that's what's happening. And I know you have a lot more to say on the subject, so I'm going to hand it back to you.
Well, I guess we've kind of beat this one down. It's probably a good idea to spread out into some other subjects at this point. I'm personally very unhappy with the members of Congress who've determined that in order to get their way and cut off aid to Ukraine, they are going to basically stop the pay for soldiers who have they're particularly the ones their families are left back here who get the paychecks. It just a lot of things boggle my mind. That attitude of we only have 20 people who want to do this out of 438 members of Congress, and the 20 people being willing to wreck everything to get what they want. I know it's happened before, but not, I guess maybe I'm getting older. I don't like it. Anyway.
I think we can say it sticks in our craw.
Yeah.
If you don't have a craw, then you need to get one.
Well, let's talk about the economy for a little bit. Let's be straight up. The U.S. In the Financial Times, there's a headline, the U.S. is on the brink of a new growth cycle. And I happen to agree with that. Why do I agree with that? Well, a couple of things are going on out there that are pretty impressive. Spending continues to rise, and it's consumer spending continues to rise. It last month, it rose at roughly 0.2%. Inflation was up 0.1%, which is it's 1.2% if you annualize it. So what we've got is this discretionary income in the United States is going up at about 2% a year, which indicates where the growth is coming from. We're having increased productivity. We're having increased wages. We have the lowest unemployment, or close to the lowest unemployment we've ever had in the history of the United States, outside of wartime where everybody gets drafted and everybody has to go to work. We have an amazingly resilient economy, and that's showing up in a lot of places. Some of the standard forecasting tools, the Purchasing Managers Index, for example, for manufacturing is down. But at the same time, durable goods orders are up. Now, what does that mean? Durable goods, particularly commercial durable goods, which is what I was looking at, are up 0.9% last month. What does that mean? Commercial durable goods mean that a company has enough money to do what they want. They've got excess money. I shouldn't say excess, but they have cash flow. They have good cash flow. They have good savings. And they've determined that within the next year or so, they're going to see more orders come in. So they invest in new equipment and buildings and expand what they're doing to accommodate the new orders that they're anticipating from. But and their customers are telling them, we're going to be making some orders next year. This is where the PMI comes in. We are seeing a temporary lag right now. It sounds like it's coming down. And it has been coming down this year in manufacturing. Well, what does that mean? Well, the problem with looking at that is it's a year-over-year measurement normally. And last year, we were still recovering from the pandemic. In other words, we were going absolutely full throttle, full afterburner in the United States in manufacturing and services and everything else. And the fact that it is a little slower now, the acceleration or even the growth rate is slower, is pulled back, and to some degree is reducing the amount of orders they're getting in, doesn't mean we're in trouble. It just means we're coming back to a sustainable rate of growth. We were running along just after the pandemic at about 3% and 4% growth per year, which in the United States economy simply can't do that. We don't. And if you wonder why the United States economy can't do that, get on I-35 most days and try to drive to either Dallas-Fort Worth or Austin, and you'll understand.
Yeah.
There's not a lot more trucks can get on that highway. It's jammed.
And you can't just add more lanes. This is something that people that study traffic have realized, that once you get above four lanes, every lane that you add doesn't add extra flow. In fact, it doesn't really do much. The diminishing return just stops. There's not really any better traffic from four.
You mean
to
four
five
lanes on each side?
Yeah. So that's an eight-lane highway. Yeah. Above that, it just doesn't. And eight lanes isn't vastly more efficient than six lanes. Six lanes is extremely efficient. You add the next lane on both sides to eight, and you don't. You would think, well, that's going to be a 33% improvement. You could jump, but it isn't. It's like a 5% improvement, and then above that, you don't get any improvement at all.
My wife and I drove to Austin last week during the week and back. And there were several instances during the middle of the day, it's not during rush hour, when the traffic slowed down. We slowed down. As a matter of fact, coming back yesterday from Georgetown, day before yesterday, coming back from Fort Worth, I had the same issue that occurred. There were no accidents. Nothing unusual happened. They're just compressions where everybody slows down and then they speed up again. That is an indication that the six-lane wide I-35 I was driving on, three lanes on each side, was at maximum capacity, so that anybody slowing down very slightly creates a compression wave that slows everybody else down. And I've seen movies of this, or I've seen videos of this from above. You see this compression wave flowing along the highway.
Which, by the upstream, way, moves backward in location. Geographically, that compression wave will move back through the traffic so long as it's at high utilization. You can watch that compression wave. So say you're in southbound traffic, you can watch it move all the way up through the state of Texas.
Yeah.
That's real. It's crazy. That means we're at capacity. We can't go much more.
We're literally at capacity. Now the railroads are saying we've finally got a little space, a little breathing space, and they have a little more capacity than they're using, although they were at maximum capacity a few months ago. But the airlines are having delays, and so we're at maximum capacity in the United States, or close to it. So we can grow at about 1.8 to 2% a year consistently over a long period of time. Anything faster than that, and we run into bottleneck.
Now, there's in the future, not even far in the future, on the traffic end, just the utilization for trucks going up and down the highway. For some reason, trucking is called shipping, which just that's hard for me. But so shipping moving up and down the highway is also hard for my 8-year-old. What? Yes, we're shipping up and down the highway in these trucks. In the future, and not that far in the future, trucks will be driving themselves. Well, what does that have to do with anything? In the history of the internet, we had these pinch points where we looked at broadband and we thought, we're never going to be able to speed this up. We've got processors that are increasing in their speed of processing really quickly, but we're at the end of what we can squeeze through this copper wire to get strong internet connection. At the beginning, everybody was just shoving information in, kind of a stream of information, and they realized, hey, we can put this into packets and put a code at the front and the back of the packet to say where it is and what connects. It's kind of like slot A into or tab A into slot B, that sort of instruction at the beginning and the end of the packet. And then instead of shoving all the information, kind of pushing it into a tube, they started firing missiles of information through it, packets. And you still get packet collision in routers, things where it's trying to send and receive at the same time. So it's gotten incredibly better at that. The software has improved and improved and improved. When we look at physical traffic, we're trying to shove a bunch of cars through a limited space. It's the same thing. And over time, as the cars are able to not only look around them and see where they are, but also to communicate with each other in traffic situations. And that's going to occur. That's going to happen. It's not happening right now. Right now, each car that drives itself is independent of the cars around it, except through a kind of a gross informational network. Tesla's beginning to communicate car to car through their network so that they can help there. But basically, in the future, cars are going to need to communicate with each other, and the whole road system will need to communicate with the cars to let them know what size of packets to be, what speed to be driving, all that stuff. And that will allow us to expand our ability to move things around the country exponentially faster. And it's kind of weird. You won't be able to drive manually on those roads. But that's, we're talking about, now we're talking about decades in the future, but we can see the technology for it today. That's where we're going. Right now, we're depending on truck drivers, and they've been through the worst whiplash of almost anybody during the pandemic. They're worse than teachers because 1 month you couldn't get enough truck drivers no matter what you paid, and the next month you're laying them all off, and then the month after that you're grabbing them all back up and bringing them back. They've been through the ringer over the past three years. The average age of truck drivers in the United States is approaching 60. What does that mean? Well, it means that the average age of the truck drivers in the United States is approaching 60. I think everybody can come to conclusions on what that means. It means what it says, but what does it mean to the future? Well, either we need a lot of young truck drivers that we're not getting. There's not a huge number of youngsters joining up in the truck driving world. Or technology is going to replace them as they retire. That's how this occurs. You don't fire people that are doing a job that you've been paying them to do efficiently. You when it comes to technology, you replace people that aren't replacing themselves. You saw this throughout the last century and a half in agriculture. In the last 30 years, there weren't massive layoffs across farms as tractors have learned to drive themselves. Just less people joined up to be a farmer. And that's what's happening in trucking right now. So technology will be stepping in. Capacity utilization will be easier then. We'll have more capacity because productivity in the way we traffic our vehicles and the way we ship on land will get better. There. That was my way too long interjection into what you were saying about capacity utilization. We're growing as fast as we possibly can right now. Faster. We can't keep this up.
And it's certainly interesting that we're growing and other places aren't too. There's reasons, obviously, but our peculiar way of doing things is the primary reason that we're doing so well. There's a lot of things going on in the United States right now simultaneously, and not the least of which is disengagement from China, which is, if you've been listening very long, and I've said this for a long time, the reason we had super low unemployment and super low inflation, the reason that all of that happened over the last decade or so is China. China's entry of cheap labor into the market. The United States invested, mainly the United States, some European capital went into China, because having a lot of labor doesn't do you any good unless you've got a lot of capital to invest to build the places for people to work. The factories that, for instance, iPhones are being made in. A lot of capital came from the United States invested in China. The capital flowing into China has just about disappeared.
Yeah.
They have excess labor again, very well-educated excess labor. They have a very high unemployment rate among young college-educated people in China. And that's not coming back. We are not going to suddenly find the government of India, for example, which, by the way, now has more people than China, suddenly change into something that will allow all those people who are behind oxen in the fields to wind up on factory floors doing work. The government is not particularly dynamic in India, and it isn't going to make big changes. So what we're going to see going forward, in my opinion, is longer-term interest rates are going to be up where they were in the 90s.
That's and pretty much where they are right now.
We're very much in the same economic condition as we were in the early 90s, early mid-90s. And we're seeing very, very fast growth because new technology is being introduced, particularly in the form of AI. We're seeing a lot of things going on that's pushing us forward. We're seeing capacity limitations push back against us, and we have a shortage of labor. Well, we had all of that back then, too. The difference is, in the 90s, companies discovered that they could expand into China, which had a very, had a very business-friendly approach.
Who?
Chairman Ding.
Yeah, I'm saying who?
Who was later?
Yes, who? I'm not sure. Who was later?
Okay.
Sorry, I can't help it. I can't help it. Bad puns with that name are mandatory, so please go ahead.
So the issue is that be prepared, looking forward, that longer, and I'm not the only person saying it, we were pretty much the only people saying this a year ago, but now it seems to be the popular song and to sing, that long-term interest rates are going to be higher than they are today. And they're not going to go back to super low anytime in the near future because we don't have another China to introduce into the system. When did this last happen? It happened in the 1920s. We're paralleling the 1920s very interestingly at this point. Where did all the labor come from in the 1920s? It came out of Eastern Europe. Following World War I, the Eastern Europe was impoverished and in pain, and they had a lot of people leaving Eastern Europe and coming into the United States. And those people were put to work on assembly lines in the United States. Ford is famous for doing that. And we had a significant drop in the cost of things. And we ran into very much the same problems we're having right now. And we'll probably have very much the same results we're having right now. But gear up in your planning for the fact that interest rates are going to trend higher through this decade, that you need to be prepared for that. And you need to recognize that those things they're cyclical. And at some point, we will get another socioeconomic crisis, probably in the early 2030s, that will cause interest rates to come back down. But these things happen for a cause. And if you look at the macroeconomics of this, you can see the cause unfolding and you can benefit from it.
Yeah.
This
is pure education, what you're talking about right here. This is fantastic. During the 90s, we had interest rates that were, compared to the last couple of decades, they sound exorbitantly high, running around in the 7 and 8% for mortgages. And it's true, but that's where it's running today. So you said we introduced a China. Well, how does this fight inflation, having cheap labor somewhere else? Well, anybody that's been in the workforce for any time in the last two decades, not counting the last 3 years, has known that if you went to your boss and you said, I want a raise, I'm doing well, they'd say, I can't give you a raise. We're competing with other people that aren't giving raises. The kind of the biggest new competitor was China. If you're making bed frames and you want a raise, well, China's going to make it cheaper. So you can't have a raise. And a lot of bed frame companies went out of business anyway. So then they had to go to work somewhere else. And again, you've got this other competitor, and it kept our prices low. At the, you know, back in the late 90s, there were all kinds of logos on everything in Walmart, made in America. Those went away. Why? Well, because of prices. They tried to stick by that, by the way, that in the boardrooms and in the executive meetings of Walmart, they worked really hard on sticking to Buy America. But they were losing business to everybody else that was suddenly able to provide cheaper products from China. So they realized that when they put a cheaper product next to a more expensive product and it had an American flag on it, people bought the cheaper product. So they did what people in marketplaces do. They replaced all the expensive American stuff with cheap Chinese stuff. And a lot of American businesses changed or went into different businesses or went out of business. Others kind of flourished in the middle of it by causing their products to be made over there. So there's this, as you said, a macroeconomic story happening here that prevented inflation for a while. We couldn't raise prices because somebody else would undercut us. And if you did it anyway, well, they would undercut you and the prices wouldn't rise. They might actually go down when you went away. So this concept of we introduced cheap labor, cheap manufacturing. Until we have the ability to introduce cheaper manufacturing again so that anybody can manufacture what you're manufacturing, and if you increase your price, then they'll just come in and undercut you, then we have to have more expensive money. Well, what does that mean? It means it's more expensive to get a loan to go into business. Otherwise, we have inflation. So we're using, it's a different tool to fight inflation. The marketplace was fighting inflation for a while. Well, that stopped. China became non-cooperative as a marketplace. What does that mean? It doesn't be a good thing, bad thing. The government said, shut down. We don't want COVID. From a marketplace perspective, the rules, the reasoning behind it don't matter. We couldn't get the things we needed. And people still wanted those things, and they were willing to pay money, more money for it. And that caused spending in other places to produce it. No business wants to say no when you're trying to give them money. It's a weird thing about business is they like money. It's very strange. If you say, I would like to buy this, and you say no, they're going to go somewhere else and buy it. And this business owner is going to want to get it. So this is the deal. During the pandemic, when we couldn't get things and people were saying, I'll pay you as much as I've got. I will pay you whatever you want for this thing. Business owners said, whoa, I got to jump on this. I need to manufacture and it's not working in China, so I'm going somewhere else. Well, the somewhere else can be more expensive than China was. China's more expensive now than it was for lots of reasons. So put that all together and we've got to wait for automation to really kick into gear to fight inflation. And that's when we could see inflation fighting, the interest rates fighting inflation come back down again. Also, the Federal Reserve has to sell a huge amount of bonds back before we see high interest rates go away. And I think we have actually beaten that subject now.
Probably have.
Yeah. We have, you know, there are really four big pieces of the economy that's really hard not to keep focusing back on right now. The oil prices, the UAW strike, the government shutdown. When you throw all and the student loan payments coming back together, when you throw that all in, that's happening right now. It's hard to talk about other things, but there are actually other things happening. As we've talked about continuously for months, we're growing at a fast rate in the United States. Our GDP is expected to be in the 4% region, between 3 and 4%. And that's faster growth than we're seeing almost anywhere else on the planet. None of the major powers of the United States are coming anywhere near that. And when you consider that the United States economy is also the biggest, having a higher percentage on a larger base means that our growth is huge right now. What's happening? Well, we're still spending and we're still hiring and we're still producing. And yes, there are pinch points, but the pinch points are how fast we expand. They're not generally slowing us down. That's exciting. Now, looking ahead, crystal balls are weird because there's no way 4 months ago we could have said, yep, the UAW is going to shut down 3 major automakers. Well, what's that doing for Tesla and Toyota? Well, if your car manufacturer starts with a T, you've just won the lottery because everybody's going to have a shortage of cars in the near future, except that Tesla and Toyota are not. And that's the UAW shooting their companies in the foot because they want something. That trend, by the way, also fits extremely well with where we are in history. You just mentioned this, that we're paralleling 1920. This was when unions were kind of reaching up and saying, hey, things are looking scary, pay us more. That's not a good time to ask for a raise, side note. When things are looking scary isn't the time that you should say, boss, I'm going to shut down the company if you don't give me a raise. And that's what's happening here. It sounds like I'm totally anti-union when I'm talking about this subject, but the timing of this strike across multiple manufacturing, this is not a good negotiation tactic. This is protection racket stuff. This is where I can point back to organized crime as a method of negotiation, only it's not crime. What they're doing is legal. It's just damaging. There are a lot better ways of negotiating for higher wages. A lot better. And unfortunately, they're not being used by either side of this. Ford seems to be trying to get to a solution, but the UAW is definitely flexing right now. Okay, so now I've kind of talked about more of the big gorillas in the room. This is a good one. This is great. I said we were going to talk about this at the beginning of the episode. Why is it that long-term interest rates are rising when the Federal Reserve didn't raise interest rates? And I've gotten that question multiple times recently. And I'll give you a quick answer to that and then a more in-depth answer. First off, the Federal Reserve doesn't touch long-term interest rates when it changes interest rates directly. They're talking about very, very, very overnight, very short rates, like just tonight rate. Not 10 years, not 30 years, not mortgage rate stuff. And the mortgage rates have been going up. The treasury rates have been going up over the last month. They've been up. They're up almost half a percentage point. When we look around, the Federal Reserve didn't raise rates. What's going on? Money is leaving the longer term market because rates are low. Would you want to loan money at 30 years at a rate that's less than you could get at the bank for leaving it there overnight? Why would you do that? So people aren't doing it, which means there's less money available to make those loans, which means that the people that are making the loans can charge more. It's supply and demand again. The longer term loans have been suffering. We've been hearing about this. There's fewer and fewer mortgages being given. Well, we're beginning to see an uptick there. Mortgages are coming back. There's fewer people making the loans because you couldn't make as much money there. So they pushed the money into shorter term stuff, which means there's less money available to make loans, which means interest rates go up. And you are looking, I may be frozen on your screen. I said, go ahead. You can add.
There's another reason that the intermediate term interest rates and long-term interest rates are going up. During the pandemic, the Fed didn't just buy short-term securities. They went out and bought long-term treasuries on the open market to put money into the system to keep us from having a collapse. And when they put the money into the system, that meant they bought longer term bonds. And now they're selling those longer term bonds to shrink their balance sheet, and they're sucking money out of the system to kill inflation. And they are the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And we need to break for commercials.
Yeah. So when we're talking about longer term rates coming up, I invite you to go back to listen to our radio conversations over the last year where we've said longer term rates are going to have to come up. People were expecting shorter term rates to come down to make the yield curve uninvert. We've been saying the long term rates are going to come up, and that's what we're saying. And it sounds like we're brilliant on this, but this is right out of textbook. Anybody can look this up in an econ textbook and say, oh, this is what happens like this. Oh, okay. And people think we're brilliant because things are functioning in very small parts of the economy the way they're supposed to. Or the rest of the economy not. We got to play some commercials. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got about 13 minutes left in the program. Probably have about 10 minutes left when we come back. The email addresses in here are Jeff at TPWC.com and Jake at TPWC.com. tangopapa.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important announcements. We're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, email addresses are waiting. Jeff@tpwc.com and Jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. You said you have a lot to talk about, so I'm going to hand it over to you. We've got about 10 minutes left. Go for it.
Well, not only is capital leaving China. I say leaving. It's not actually leaving China. The U.S. capital, money invested, has been flowing into China for about 20 years at a very high rate of speed. We've built a lot of buildings. We've bought a lot of equipment. I mean, United States companies have done that, just as they did into Russia to a lesser degree. And they're now recognizing that sunk cost is sunk. It's gone. And they're beginning to disengage. But it's going to be very slow, and it's going to take several years. The big thing that's happening is the capital is no longer flowing into China. Now, that is where things get bumpy. China is having some difficulty finding capital, which is one of the reasons their economy isn't having any trouble with inflation, but rather with deflation, and they have a potential for a recession in front of them, which they are vigorously trying to head off. So where is the capital going to go if we're going to continue to grow? If the United States is growing quickly, and it is, and we don't have the capacity in the United States to grow quickly, that means we need to grow somewhere else. Mexico and Vietnam are probably the two biggest.
Canada has gotten a big boost as well.
Right. We've already had a lot of growth going on in India, but basically South Asia and Mexico are the emerging markets where we're seeing capital flowing in and people being employed and things being made. India doesn't have a particularly stable government. Obviously, there's problems with the government in Mexico. But one of the things that needs to be borne in mind here is proximity. The closer a country is to the United States, the cheaper it is to get goods manufactured in that country into the United States. And I think there's going to continue to be a concerted effort to site as much manufacturing as we can in northern Mexico. And that is not taking jobs away from the United States. The problem we're running into in the United States is we don't have enough people to work in the factories. We simply don't have the population. Our population is no longer growing fast. A lot of the people who work in the factories at the automakers and the people who make parts for automobiles and airplanes and whatever else in the United States, they're having a lot of trouble finding employees, and the average age, or the median age, even the median age of their employees on these on this equipment is getting quite old. So we've got a two-pronged effort that we'll see emerge more and more during this decade, in my opinion. One, we will see more in northern Mexico, more factories and so on in northern Mexico, which incidentally may have an interesting side effect. We may find some way to stabilize the government in northern Mexico. I'm not sure exactly how we're going to do it, but it wouldn't be the first time in our history we've done something like that.
Well, I mean, I can throw something in there. The marketplace is definitely going to help here. There has been a migration in Mexico to the factories in northern Mexico. And there's also been a market for the drugs that come through Mexico from South America and that originate in Mexico. And the Mexicans have really taken over that. The cartels in Mexico have taken over the other cartels for lots of reasons, but anarchy doesn't work well long term. So the gangs down south didn't do as well as the semi-government of Mexico and their gangs. And I know that's weird. As other parts of the economy become stronger than the drug market, and that's happening right now. It's already transpired. It's already occurred that you can get a job at a factory. You don't have to go work at a drug plant. Then as that occurs, the marketplace is going to step in and protect that. The more we shift factory working to northern Mexico, the more stable the government there will be, so long as it's being done correctly. And that's, I think, where you're talking about. How do we stabilize that? The government there has to get stabilized. There's a lot of corruption.
Right.
But the reality is that they are so close to the United States, we do have an influence on what's happening there. I'm not sure that it's ethical, but we have the influence.
I would not be terribly surprised to see us take, at some point in the next decade, a direct hand in intervention against the cartels and warlords in northern Mexico.
Yeah.
We're not there yet, but I wouldn't be too surprised to see that.
It has happened in the past. I mean,
yes,
we make it
twice.
Very, very romantic, but Pancho Villa was a bandit that was disrupting trade. And so the United States government invaded Mexico. I am not suggesting that we invade Mexico. Just a side note, that would be a really, really not good thing right now. But working with Mexico would be a compromise there.
And I think there's a lot of effort to do that. It deteriorated under the previous administration because of some of the things the president was saying about Mexicans, broad stroke, but I think it's coming back now. So we're seeing some offshoring going on, but the second prong to that solution, and I think it is probably ultimately going to be the biggest one, is again paralleled in the 1920s. In the 1920s, there was a huge displacement of workers from farms, an immense displacement of workers, as the internal combustion engine increased the productivity of farms and replaced people. A tractor with its implements easily replaces 5 or 6 farmhands. And that the new factories that are being built around the country are very, very highly very, very highly automated. And as the software and AI capacity continues to grow through the decade, I think you'll see more and more and more of that. And that will be ultimately our good solution to the problem, which we'll work on becoming more and more that way through this entire century. I think it's going to, again, the internal combustion engine, which is ironically being phased out at this point. By 2050, there probably won't be a lot of gasoline-powered cars to be found anywhere. And we see that tremendous disturbance that was caused in the 1920s by automobiles, by the way, which ultimately led in many ways to World War II, because Germany got ahead of the power curve on this new equipment and could do blitzkrieg. And at the beginning of World War II, and this is a thing a lot of people didn't realize, the Polish army, when Germany invaded Poland using mechanized vehicles and early tanks, lightweight tanks, the Polish army still had mounted cavalry on horses.
Just to make it apparent that they still weren't weak, they destroyed more tanks in Poland than the French did in France. And the French had a more mechanized military. The military of Poland on the backs of horses destroyed more tanks than...
But those were very, very primitive, very early tanks. But what we're seeing, and by the way, we're seeing this happen again, war in again between Ukraine and Russia is becoming, has become already, radically different than anyone imagined it would be. The predominance of drones in warfare is astonishing a lot of people. And we'll see this accelerate as drones get smarter and smarter, and this goes on. So this is the 1920s and the 2020s are going to be stages of disruption where a lot of people are put out of work. But because our population is not growing really, really fast, it won't be as disruptive.
Do you have a wrap up for this week? What are things people can do right now?
Well, for one thing, there is an outflow from banks for the first time in, I think, about 40 years. There's actually an outflow from banks to places that are paying higher interest. Some banks have got the capacity to pay you 5% interest on a CD or something, and that's wonderful. But a lot of other banks, they haven't stepped forward to do that. And the money is leaving there and moving to Treasury money market funds, which is very appropriate because that's loaning money to the Treasury just as the Treasury is borrowing a lot of money. It works out very well for everybody for that. That's going on. You might want to look at that. You might want to look to say, if you've got some big deposits at the bank, don't go over $250,000, certainly, and you're not getting any interest on it, you probably can convince the bankers to give you more interest. The economic condition of the United States right now and the psychological condition of the United States right now suggests that we're at the bottom of a bear market, not at the top of a bull market. There's no guarantees about this, obviously, but I'm not the only person to be very optimistic about the future.
Yeah.
And we're out of time.
Yep. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
Or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. We actually do give fiduciary investment advice and portfolio management for people of relatively high net worth. You can also go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can read our newsletter, sign up for it, get it every Friday. You can listen to our radio program and podcasts. You can find those podcasts anywhere you can find podcasts, or you can contact us through the contact form. Email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.